Blog Talk Radio.
Radio. I'm so glad that you could be here. I'm your host, Susan Knowles, and you can find me and more information about my articles and the radio show at SusanKnowles.com. That's SusanKnowles.com. I hope everybody had a great week. I know that for some of us in traveling, I know it's been kind of difficult out there with all the snow, but for all of you that went to CPAC, I certainly hope that you found it at least very encouraging, if not inspiring, and that you have a lot of good things to share with people now that you're back from that. I wanted to get started tonight. We are very fortunate to have with us tonight our guest, Rich Lowrie, and that's Lowrie. And I want to let you know that Rich is co-founder and senior advisor for Put Growth First, and that's an organization that educates, advocates, and consults on pro-growth economic policy. Rich is also was in a former role as senior economic advisor for Friends of Herman Cain. And he co-wrote the 999 Plan and the book 999, An Army of Davids. If you want to call in with any questions, please feel free. 4-7-2-0-5-9-6-2-0. Or you can, as always, ask the question in the chat room, and I'll certainly be glad to relay it to Rich. So without further ado, Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Susan. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you could come on. I know there's a lot of information that I want to talk to you about tonight, so I'm kind of eager to get started so that we can sort of pick your brain, since you're the you know, the economic guru and that we've had on the show. So,
all right, let's get started.
Let's talk about your organization. As I mentioned, you are with Put Growth First. What? Tell us a little bit about what that organization is about, and then I have some questions to ask you in regards to that organization and what may have gone on during CPAC. But for right now, tell me what that organization is about and what you do there.
Well, it's kind of like you said, we educate, advocate, and advise on pro-growth economic policy. And, you know, we've found that there's so much misunderstanding about how the economy works. I mean, it's almost as if these days anything could pass as economic stimulus. Just about anything can be positioned, oh, it's going to help the economy. Well, the economy works in a certain way where there's one thing and only one thing that drives economic growth. And once you understand that, the pieces just seem to fit together more nicely. It seems to make sense. And I get a lot of people tell me that, you know, it's common sense when you have it explained to you the right way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's really missing in Washington is a cohesive, credible pro-growth agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And when we don't have a pro-growth agenda, it seems that the debate devolves into one of redistribution versus austerity.
Right.
Redistribution obviously doesn't work, and unfortunately, austerity doesn't either. It has a high political cost, and economically, it's just ineffective. And if you compare the benefits of economic growth versus the benefits of austerity, there's really no comparison. And all of our problems stem from one core problem, which is a lack of robust economic growth. So the good news is, if you get out a sheet of paper and write down all the problems you think we have, you probably could come up with 50 or more problems, unfortunately. But the good news is they all trace back to one thing, is our lack of economic growth. And if we can solve that one thing, then the rest start to take care of themselves or at least become easier to manage.
And I know a lot of people think that, you know, the way to solve that is to, you know, get the Democrat out of the White House and put a Republican in. And, you know, I'm a little leery of even the Republicans these days. I know a lot of people are kind of disappointed in how the Republicans are handling things. So, you know, are they really equipped to lead us down a path of economic growth?
Well, I think we're getting there. There are an awful lot of good members of the House. It may not show up in the polling that shows the public has a poor perception of Congress, but I think the gene pool in Congress today is the best it's ever been. And, you know, if you go back to look at the Reagan revolution, think about the difference then versus the difference now. You know, you had no cable TV, no Fox News, no Internet. You had no Facebook, no Twitter, no Club for Growth, no Freedom Works, no Heritage, no Cato. But the only thing they had then was a small group of Jack Kemp, Art Laffer, Jude Winiski, and Bob Mundell, who one by one told the story of growth to another member of Congress, who then said to his colleague, hey, you got to talk to these guys. It really makes a lot of sense. And before you knew it, it was a small group, enough of a critical mass, to get behind the Kemp-Roth bill, which was on the table before Reagan ran. And Reagan kind of breathed life into it. Reagan had a way, obviously, of communicating with people, and he basically said, if elected president, I will sign that. And then he just went out and communicated the benefits to the people of the Kemp-Roth plan, which, you know, if you apply it to today, we spend too much time selling the features and not enough time selling the benefits. And if you could get all it takes is a small group of committed members of the House to put together the right program and then go out and talk about the benefits of it, they have a chance to shape the 2016 election if anyone thinks that we need to wait for the president to do something, I think it's backwards. I think you need the House to do something. And then that positions the 2016 candidates to differentiate who will support that and who will not. And if you get everybody saying they're going to support it, that's kind of the goal. Then we can decide the president based on who is most credible when they say they're going to enact it.
And who do you think right now, you mentioned that there are some really good people in Congress, who in Congress right now do you think really understands the powerfulness, you know, the economic growth and the necessity of it? Who would that be?
Well, I mean, there's a lot, and I'll name names, but I'm afraid I'll leave some out, and I'll regret the fact that I leave some out. But just off the top of my head, you have Jim Jordan, who's outstanding. You have Marlon Stutzman from Indiana. You have Mick Mulvaney from South Carolina. You have Raul Labrador from Idaho. You have Scott Garrett from New Jersey. You have Mark Meadows from North Carolina. You have John Fleming from Louisiana. Let's see. You have Ron DeSantis from Florida. You have Matt Salmon from Arizona. You have Jeb Henseling in Texas. Bill Huizenga in Michigan. Justin Amash in Michigan. I could go on and on because I know I'm missing at least another, you know, dozen guys. But we have, again, the best gene pool we've ever had.
I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was going to say I didn't hear you mention California. What's that?
Well, you know, I was thinking about California. I know McClintock is from California. He's great.
Mm-hmm.
Tom McClintock. I mean, Kevin Brady in Texas. How could I forget Kevin Brady in Texas? He's outstanding. There's just a lot of them. And
okay. Well.
You know, what I see from working with a number of them is that they tend to get pulled down in silos based on their committee assignments.
Right.
And if you see how much work gets assigned to each of these committees, it's amazing that these guys can even keep up on their own committee work, let alone feel informed enough about someone else's committee, you know, to comment on it. So a lot of times, mm-hmm. I'll give you a good example. House Financial Services wants to end the Export-Import Bank, as they should. It's the bank of crony capitalism.
Right.
And they hand out care subsidies to Boeing and all kinds of big corporations. And the problem exists in our tax code. Our tax code double taxes exports, does not tax imports, creates an uneven playing field on both counts, and, of course, it puts our companies at a competitive disadvantage. So they go to Washington and say, hey, we're at a competitive disadvantage, and leave it to Washington to say, let us come up with, you know, another government program. We'll call it a bank, and we'll hand out subsidies to you guys. Well, the problem exists in the tax code. The symptoms are treated through the Export-Import Bank, which is on financial services in a completely different committee than the Ways and Means. But not one person last year mentioned, who was from financial services, not one person mentioned that the source of the problem is the Ways and Means Committee. I'm sorry, the source of the problem is the tax code, which should be addressed by the Ways and Means Committee.
Right.
And likewise, nobody on Ways and Means spoke up about Export-Import Bank because there's a stay-in-your-lane mentality. So if you can get a couple of these guys to see that the economy works across all the committees, and we need to rise above the silos and connect some dots in order to put together a, you know, credible program that puts us on offense.
Now, you, when you were at CPAC, I know that you were really busy and you weren't just sitting around listening to, you know, speech after speech. So tell me a little bit about what you were involved in when you were there and that task force, something that you were involved in.
Yeah, well, I think each year I go to CPAC, I spend less time in the actual sessions and more time kind of networking with, you know, people, connecting with people that you may interact with throughout the year, where CPAC may be a convenient time you know, for everybody to get together. And then I also had a day on Capitol Hill where part of that time was spent working with a number of members of Congress to launch a growth task force. And the growth task force would be designed to answer these questions. Can we solve our problems with economic growth? If so, how much more do we need? Once we know how much we need, how do we generate that growth? How do we make sure that growth lifts the 100% and not just the top 10? How do you communicate a growth agenda to the electorate? And then how do you overcome some of these built-in obstacles in D.C., some of which are self-imposed, that stack the deck against growth? Because if you answer all six of the previous questions and you don't answer the last one, you're probably not going to get too far. It's going to be one more thing that just gets bogged down in Congress. And, you know, the answers to this is all, they're all encouraging. Yes, emphatically, we can solve our problem with growth. Growth is 27 times more effective at reducing spending, at reducing the deficit, at reducing the debt than cutting spending. And it may not sound intuitive at first, but think about spending goes in the numerator and GDP goes in the denominator. You can reduce spending and the deficit and the debt by reducing the numerator, but it's much, much, much more effective to increase the denominator. If you want to get spending down to 16%, 15%, 14% of GDP, you get there much faster increasing GDP. You know, once you get to the next question of how much more growth do we need, sadly, nobody knows. I mean, it's unbelievable. Given kind of the financial threat that we face, if we continue to accept stagnation versus the benefit of generating more economic growth, then nobody knows how much more we need. So one of the things the task force will look at is getting the Social Security trustees to reverse engineer their model. And they should tell us how much growth we need to fund entitlement programs without cutting benefits. I mean, there's no doubt entitlements need to be reformed. But the time to reform them, like we did in the 90s, is when the economy is prosperous and everybody who wants a job can have one. That's the time that we did welfare reform, and that's the time, you know, that we should undertake entitlement reform now. But Social Security assumes a 2.1% forecast for 75 years. And then they tell us the programs are not sustainable and they blow up. Well, no kidding. I mean, 2.1% growth is, you know, stagnation that the country just is not built for. We've grown at 3.96% for 180 years. I mean, think about that kind of growth. And since 1971, we lost at 4%, and we've only grown at 2.8. Since 2000, we've lost yet another percent. We've only grown at like 1.7. We need to get back to 4% growth and sustain it for 20 years. And it starts with Social Security trustees telling us the rate of growth we need to achieve. That becomes our target growth rate. Once everyone knows our target growth rate, then we can get onto the business of saying, okay, how do we generate 1% more incremental growth or 1.5% more incremental growth? Once you get to that point, there's really only one way to generate growth, and that's through business investment. You know, there's this superstition in economics, and it's pure superstition, that says consumption drives the economy. And because of that, it allows the left to justify redistribution. And nobody really steps in to defeat that argument.
Right.
If you want, you can prove it empirically. I can ship you to a deserted island of Alaska, or you're the island's only inhabitant. And then I can say, okay, Susan, show me how you can consume something before you produced it. And you just can't do it.
No.
Kind of jealous and say no. Madison Paul Krugman there. And he'll either spend the rest of his life figuring out how to do it, in which case he stays isolated where he can do no further damage, or he figures it out and has to become a supply center. And then, you know,
well,
so if oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, it's almost like common sense. You take the economics out of it, but common sense would tell you that you have to have, if you're going to consume, you have to have growth. You know, it's kind of a balancing that you have to do. You can't just take, and give out all these programs and not have anything in return to replenish what you've done.
Yeah. Yeah, so, it you know, the engine pulls the train down the tracks. The caboose doesn't push it.
Mm-hmm.
And the left has everyone thinking that the caboose pushes the train down the tracks. They advocate putting fuel in the caboose. And then when it doesn't work, you get guys like Paul Krugman say, well, that's because we didn't put enough fuel in the caboose. Someone needs to step up and say it didn't work because the caboose doesn't push the train. The fuel belongs
right.
in the engine. And the fuel is business investment. Every dollar of business investment generates 45 cents of GDP every year. So once you see go ahead.
I was going to say, do they really believe that, or is that just, you know, the progressive agenda? Is that just what they say in order to finally get what
both.
They want?
I think it's both. I think some people actually believe it, and I think some people know better, and it's like, well, hey, let's just keep running the same play until they stop us.
Uh-huh.
And as long as we're not going to stop them, why should they change their playbook and run any different place? You know, and part of it goes back to this equation that's in Economics 101. Some of your listeners may remember seeing it. It says GDP equals consumption plus government spending plus investment plus net exports. If you add up all those categories, it equals GDP. It does indeed equal GDP, but that equation exists only to do one thing, which is to measure GDP or count GDP. It doesn't say one thing about how it was produced in the first place, let alone how to produce more. And that equation creates an optical illusion that you can increase consumption and you increase GDP, or you can increase government spending and increase GDP. So we have to demolish that equation, which you can easily do by, you know, issuing a challenge and offer to send somebody to Alaska and have them prove that they can consume something before they can produce it.
Right.
A better way of looking at the economy would be through a return on asset equation, just like you would look at any business. But instead of putting profit in the numerator, you basically put GDP. So you look at GDP relative to assets. Assets are the only things that produce GDP. You can have either residential assets or non-residential assets, and you could break GDP down into residential and non-residential. So you take residential assets divided by, residential GDP divided by residential assets, it equals 7%. When you take non-residential GDP divided by non-residential assets, you get 45%. So even a liberal would know 45 cents is larger than 7 cents.
Right.
And those are the only two ways you can expand GDP is by expanding the base of assets that produce GDP. And if the choice is between 7 and 45, obviously the non-residential, the business investment, is the way to go. And then it becomes a matter of saying, all right, if we want 1% more GDP, and GDP is $17 trillion, it means we need $170 billion more GDP. If every dollar of business investment generates 45 cents of GDP, we need somewhere around $380-390 billion of business investment. That's it. That's what everybody should be talking about. How do we get $390 billion more in business investments? Because that will get us 1% more GDP, and 1% more GDP solves the deficit and the debt and the spending problems. And if we keep the focus on that conversation, we'll get the same answers that businesses are telling us right now. They're going to say, well, in order to get more business investment, we need to reform the tax code. We need to repeal Obamacare. We need to smack down the EPA. We need to restructure all these government departments and agencies that have become hostile to business. And most important, we need to stabilize the dollar.
I agree with everything you say there. I mean, it sounds like such a great plan, but it seems like, especially in this administration, the only thing that we are set to do is, number one, print as much money as we can and keep on printing it. You know, number two, have all of these, you know, government entities that are appointed by the president basically, you know, just start controlling more and more and more and more land, taking things away from the common person, taking their land, taking their money, whatever can be done. It's kind of like making law and legislation without having to go through Congress. And it seems like all we're doing, you know, is bypassing the people that are supposed to be able to help us get to where we need to go. But right now, also, it seems that in our leadership in the House and, you know, the Republicans, let me just put it out straight there, it seems like they're more in the mode of, how can I please this president? How can I not cause waves? Let me just get along. And, you know, how do we get people to start changing that? And because every time something comes along and we say, this is going to work, the Republicans are afraid to put it forth because they're afraid they're going to offend someone or they're going to lose their base while they've already lost their base,
you know,
for the most part.
So far, these battles boil down to, you know, Obama has an unlimited supply of matches.
Mm-hmm.
And he can start a fire over here, and then we have to rush to it to put out the fire or the house burns down. And while we're doing that, he's off starting another match. And he keeps doing that. So these debates, often boil down to tactics where we're constantly on defense and we're basically saying, what's the best way to defend Obama?
Right.
And sure, there was a lot of argument last session of Congress where we only had the House. I mean, we were very limited in what we could actually do. The electorate sent us reinforcements, and we now have the Senate. But there's still limits to what we can do because we can't, automatically just override a veto.
Right.
Rather than debating what defensive strategy or what defensive game plan is the best, we need to go on offense and put the other team on defense. And when you step back and say, economic stagnation is what caused the problem to begin with. And it also holds the answer as to what the solution is. But beyond economic stagnation, you have income stagnation for the bottom 90% of the country for 40 years. So think about that.
Yep.
From 1948 to 1971, which is the post-war era, characterized by a stable dollar by the Fed. Income for the bottom 90% of the country went up 86%. That was the golden age of the middle class. That was the rising tide lifts all boats. And in 1971, we changed the Fed, and we left the stable dollar and went to the floating dollar and ushered in a regime of discretion at the Fed. Over the years, that has evolved into the Fed thinking that wage growth is inflation. As a result of the Fed thinking wage growth is inflation, you have stagnant income for the bottom 90% of the country for 40 years. Every time in the last 40 years, you've had any kind of growth strong enough to lift income of the bottom 90%, at a certain point, the Fed steps in, raises interest rates. In their mind, wage growth is what ignites inflation. So how convenient for the Fed to transition from a classical view that says the Fed causes inflation to one now where they say the labor market causes inflation. And you can't have that much stagnation for that many people for that long and not expect that that is going to increase the demand for government. Because of that stagnation, people say, You got to do something about student loans. You got to do something about health care. You got to do something because they don't see the market working. And when you have a Fed that thinks wage growth is inflation, the market is not working. We don't have free enterprise as long as that's the case. That's the piece that we have to connect into. The bottom 90% is the largest political demographic under the sun. And the one thing that unites everybody, above all, is income growth. So why not come out with a strategy and say, number one, we acknowledge the problem. 40 years of stagnant income for the bottom 90% is a problem, and we're going to fix it. We're going to make the Fed go back to stabilizing the dollar, which forces them out of labor markets. They now cannot do anything if unemployment gets, quote, unquote, too low in their book. If too many people get a raise, if too many people get too much of a raise, they're completely removed from labor markets. The result of that is going to be wage growth. And once the bottom 90 experiences wage growth again, then we should just keep coming back and saying the next thing we do to continue wage growth is scrap Obamacare. And after that, the next thing we do to generate income growth with 100% is scrap the tax code. And there's a reason the tax codes, the tax cuts have lost some luster, have lost some support, and that is because it looks as if they haven't benefited everybody. But the truth is, it's the Fed, not the tax cuts. So, for example, 1982, Reagan's tax cuts were fully implemented. They did exactly what they are supposed to do, what they're expected to do, and that is lift income of the 100%. When income in the bottom 90% went up about 8%, the Fed raised rates 9 consecutive times, enough to put us in the next recession and, quote, unquote, cool off the labor market or create slack in the labor market. And it wasn't until 94 we had the House Republican landslide. The contract with America that included the capital gain tax cut, where income for the bottom 90 started to rise again. And by 99, it got to a certain level where the Fed said, hey, enough is enough. We don't want this to start, wage inflation. And they raised rates 6 consecutive times to stamp that out. And then the 2003 Bush tax cuts delivered the only income growth the bottom 90 has seen in the last decade. And the Fed stamped it out ultimately with 17 rate hikes. It's not the tax cuts that haven't benefited everyone. It's that the Fed hasn't allowed it to happen.
So when they, like right now, the strategy is to let's continue to print money and let's increase minimum wage. By increasing the minimum wage, you're not increasing the bottom 90%. You're increasing what, the bottom 1%? And what, that has no impact, really, other than raise costs for everybody else. It has no overall positive impact for the economy.
Right. It has no impact whatsoever.
Yeah, but people that, are getting that are saying, oh, my gosh, look at this. I'm getting a raise of $8, whatever. And they don't see what it's going to do. So how do you,
I think the burden is on our side. We either accept 40 years of income stagnation and allow the left to increase the minimum wage, or we commit to fixing the problem and say, we're going to increase market wages. We're going to increase income for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you get a lot more votes for that.
Absolutely. I think people, like you said, they're tired of not seeing
income. It's the one thing that everybody agrees on.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one thing that everybody agrees on. It's selling the benefit, not the future. Mm-hmm. When we go around and say, hey, we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world, we need to reduce it. That's a true statement.
Right.
But we're not helping people translate that into what it means for them personally. The better approach would be to say, we want to deliver income growth to the 100%.
Right.
Step one is change the Fed so they can't treat wage growth as inflation. Mm-hmm. And the result will be wage growth. Then, in order to drive more and more growth that benefits more and more people, it goes back to business investment. Everything begins and ends with business investment. And then I think if you had to sell corporate tax cuts, you do it on the basis of that's what is going to drive business investment. And once we fix the Fed, everybody's going to benefit. It's kind of like putting the chain back on the bike first and then pedaling. Fixing the Fed puts the chain back on the bike.
Yeah.
Then we can pedal. And our policies work. Yeah, exactly.
So looking at, you know, potential presidential candidates, and of course we don't know who all is really going to be there, but who do you think, just kind of looking at the array of people, might follow this strategy?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I think what we're trying to do is get around and brief all of the candidates or all the presidential campaigns on this one issue of 40 years of stagnant income to the bottom 90% as being the core problem, the only core problem. Everything else you can think of is a symptom of this problem. And the solution, believe it or not, is simple. Get the Fed to stabilize the dollar. So it doesn't require any incredible degree of difficulty coming up with some complex 2,000-page bill. It's just as simple as the Office of Weights and Measures gives us a stable foot, a stable hour, and a stable pound, and the Fed should give us a stable dollar. On that basis, I hope all the presidential candidates adopt it, and then the electorate decides which one is the most credible, which one has the best experience, et cetera. If some are in favor of it and some are not, then at least in my book, it disqualifies the ones that don't get it. And I think if we're left with that all agree the Fed has to stabilize the dollar, that's the only way we're going to get sustained wage growth, then we've kind of narrowed the race down. And I think we've narrowed it down on the most important issue.
Right. Well, I mean, so far I haven't heard all of the strategy of this person, but it seems like so far Scott Walker seems to understand economics, what he's done in his own state. So it'd be interesting to hear what he has to say about this and if he's really on board and really gets it. Because right now, like I said, it appears that he might.
He's very impressive.
Yeah, he really is, and more so of every other candidate. And then it's amazing how he sort of came out of the woodwork all of a sudden. Now, I know that, Rand Paul won the straw poll at CPAC, but I'm not sure, kind of what that's all based on. And I understand that, his father at one point had won the straw poll, and that's kind of something that they get people to kind of vote for him there.
The demographics of CPAC are heavily, heavily skewed toward younger people. And I don't have the numbers from this year, but I know in past years, the younger demographic, whether they define that as, 30 and under, 29 and under, I don't know exactly where they make the cutoff, but probably 40-45% of the attendees are from that demographic, which is opposite of what election turnout looks like. The election turnout is typically higher as you move up in age brackets. CPAC is kind of the reverse. Most attendees are the youngest, and then attendance drops, as age goes up. So I think if you adjust for demographics, Rand Paul had a solid showing. But those can't be translated into, kind of Republican primary type numbers. So I think if you make that adjustment, the ones that finish just behind Rand Paul, which would be Scott Walker, Ben Carson had a pretty strong showing. I forget who was right at that group, but there were three clustered just behind Rand Paul.
I think Ted Cruz, I believe, was one of
Ted
them.
Ted Cruz, exactly. So to me, I looked at it and said, yeah, that's a good showing for Rand Paul on the surface, but adjusting for the demographics, it was maybe a more impressive showing for Walker, Cruz, and Carson.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, what's the attraction with Rand Paul for the younger crowd? I mean, I'm a little bit, you know, fascinated by that and kind of don't understand it, confused a little bit at the same time because, you know, here he is a person who endorsed Mitch McConnell, seems to kind of blow a little bit with the wind. Every time the wind changes, he kind of changes a little bit. What's the fascination, if you know?
Well, I think just in general, you know, he's gone out of his way to connect with his audience. And there's a lot to be said for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll give you an example. This doesn't relate to Rand Paul, but this is a different example that makes the same points. I have a friend that does government relations for the Teamsters. And, you know, I'll have meetings with him in Washington, and he kind of leans in and wags his finger at me. He's like, look, let me tell you something you Republicans don't understand. My guys earn a lot of money. They work hard. They hate paying taxes. They go to church on Sundays. They own guns. They love to hunt. They hate the SEIU as much as you guys do. But you lump all unions together, and nobody bothers to reach out to my guys. And they get turned off by it.
Right.
So, I mean, it tells me there's a wide-open demographic there of people that like to work, don't like paying taxes, go to church, own guns, hate SEIU. We should be going after these guys, but we don't. So we're not going to get any if we don't go after them. I think Rand Paul has picked the demographic, and he's gone after them. And I think the younger people are more open to libertarian philosophy, where they're with us on, you know, economic issues, but are likely to be more moderate or even liberal on social issues. And it's kind of a difficult, you know, a difficult line because I agree with him. We should get the government out of all that stuff. But what happens if they're in all that stuff now? If the government's in all that stuff now, it doesn't seem like a practical solution to say, hey, well, the government should just be out of it. We should just, you know, not address this because this isn't a role of government. Well, they're already knee-deep into all of it.
Right. Yeah, and it's one thing to say they need to be out, but it's another thing to say how do we start taking them out of it. I mean, I do think there's a way to start, you know, diminishing the role of government, but because we are so far into it, like you said, it's going to take a while, and it can't be just, you know, just chop a unit off. You know, it has to be somehow just slowly shrink the size of the unit rather than just getting rid of an entire unit, whatever branch that is. But it sounds good.
Yeah, it starts with delivering income growth to the 100%. Mm-hmm. The more people feel the benefit of free enterprise, the more they're going to want what we have to offer. And they're not going to want as much as what the other team has to offer. And that's the key. I mean, if you go back to 1960, that was in the middle of this period from 1948 to 71, where income for the bottom 90% went up 86%. And John Kennedy ran on a platform of supply-side tax cuts, a strong dollar, free trade, and strong national defense. Obviously, Lyndon Johnson drifted to the left, which kicked off murderer's row of economic policy between Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Carter. And by 80, Reagan made those same issues conservative, part of the conservative platform. Based on Reagan's policies, where we had income growth throughout much of the 80s and much of the 90s, by 1999, the bottom 90% was the most prosperous they've been in all of these 40 years. And the electorate rewarded us by saying, congratulations, you guys have finally figured out what the number one issue is to us, and you managed to deliver it, which is income growth.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll give you the president, the Senate, the House, a majority of state governors, a majority of state legislatures, a majority of Supreme Court appointments, majority of Federal Reserve appointments were all Republican. You can't get any more power than that. In 1960, when the Democrats delivered income growth to this driving majority, all seven of those levers of power were Democrat. By 2000, the same seven levers were Republican. The electorate never changed throughout this whole period. The parties did. The electorate wanted then, under Kennedy, what they wanted under Reagan, what they still want today, which is income growth. And the proof is the electorate will give absolute power to the party that delivers income growth to the striving majority. So if you think of the mandate, strong enough to repeal Obamacare, strong enough to do anything that's high on your priority list, there's one clear path to do it. Deliver income growth to the striving majority. They'll give us all the power we need to keep the income growth going. And as long as this priority or this issue can be viewed as a means to continue delivering income growth, we'll be able to do it.
Yeah, and you know, if you look at it, I think that's one of the things that Obama accomplished, believe it or not. I think he told his base that, you know, I'm going to give you this, I'm going to give you that. It was give, 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 give. And at the same time, it didn't matter where it came from. They just heard, you know, we're going to give you this. And I think that just the idea of receiving something they hadn't gotten for so long in their minds, it united all of the base and brought them out. And I think our base, we really do need to touch a chord in people and, you know, have this uniting force. We haven't had that in a very long time. And we have an issue right now in that, you know, we have a trust issue with our own party because they don't follow through on things that they say they're going to do. And
well,
I think that's going to be
point.
Another thing.
That's an excellent point. The left sells a tangible product.
Mm-hmm.
So they can sell the features.
Right.
They can say, here's an EBT card with $200 loaded up on it. Vote for me.
Right.
The electorate can size that up and understand whether they want to pursue that or not. And the longer we let this income stagnation go on, the more and more people are going to give into that and say, well, you know what? I pay taxes in my whole life, and I'm not seeing income growth. I get a 2%
right.
raise when the cost of living goes up 2%. I'm not getting ahead. So I've paid enough
right.
into the system. I can justify taking from the system now. And it even the stagnation even creates a perverse mentality to get as much as you can. Heck, you paid for it. The right sells an intangible. We go out and try to sell liberty and limited government. And if the bottom 90% has experienced stagnant income for 40 years, limited government doesn't sound good to them. They
right.
think something's broken in the economy and that government is the only force strong enough to get in there and wrestle with business and try to fix it. So I don't blame the left for capitalizing on the stagnation. In fact, I think the stagnation is the miracle grow for progressivism. And they're going to keep growing as long as we let the stagnation continue.
Absolutely.
What we have to do is transition from selling the features of conservative policies to selling the benefit of conservative policies. And again, the benefit is income growth.
Right.
If we fix that, the rest starts to fix itself.
Yeah, and I do think, too, that our voters, you know, the Republican voters, they just see it as, you know, why go vote? I'm going to get the same as usual. Nothing's going to change. We're just going to hear all the promises, and we're not going to get anything. Nothing in my pocket is going to change at all. And I do think, like you said, you know, that talking to them about income growth would be something that would, if they saw it and they saw that it could work and they saw that everybody was behind it and you know, in Congress and everything, and people were really excited about it and really just, you know, give some concrete examples like you've done and make, you know, simplify it. I think if they could see that they would get excited enough to get out and vote.
No,
I think it'd be a good thing.
I agree. I mean, the electorate is a market.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're the party of markets, we need to respect the sophistication of the electorate. Now, the average voter
exactly.
can still be low information, just like the average investor is low information, but the stock market in general is highly sophisticated and capable of processing enormous amounts of information. The electorate is the same way. The electorate, by definition, has among itself all the information there is to know.
Right.
And it's very sophisticated in the aggregate, which is something totally different than this concept of the low information voter. And one thing I see holds us back on our side is if you have a good idea, a good policy, a good strategy, too often someone speaks up and says, oh, yeah, but the low information voter is never going to understand that. And that's just the wrong model.
Right.
So what if the average low information voter doesn't understand it? We need to speak to the broad electorate who will understand it, and then let the market work from there. The people that do get it will carry it to the people in their network, and along the way, someone will find a more effective way to, put it in a soundbite.
And
effective ones are going to carry, and the less successful ones are going to die. And before you know it, someone's come up with a clever way of positioning this that nobody would have thought of up front.
But I do think the one thing that everybody understands is I either have more money in my pocket or I don't. Because people understand gas prices go up means I have less money to spend. I don't have money to buy food. This, that, and the other. They do understand it. It's concrete. It's simple. It's a very simple concept that you don't have to teach anyone. They already know it for the most part. I'd say 90%. Already know that. Yeah. So I do think that
is something.
Sell
the benefit, not the future.
Exactly. Absolutely. Now we have about 8 minutes left, so I want to talk a little bit about Herman Cain. How did you meet him? How did that get started?
Well, I first met him at a Club for Growth conference when he ran for the Senate in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And as I think most people who have seen Herman talk or perform, he makes quite a first impression on people.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of had him, although he didn't win his race, I kind of kept him on my radar screen, and I thought, wow, this guy would be great for the Senate, and followed his radio show after that. Separately, I got involved with Americans for Prosperity when they opened a chapter in Ohio, and I kind of helped the state director come up with a plan to replace Ohio's tax code with a flat tax. And the Americans for Prosperity headquarters says, we're going to send out a celebrity guy for you to take around to meet some potential donors for this. And it's a guy named Herman Cain. And I thought, well, that's perfect, because I met him 2 years prior, and I loved the guy. I thought he was great. So that was kind of my second interaction with Mr. Cain. And through Americans for Prosperity, I also met Mark Block, who later became the campaign manager and did the famous smoking guy ad.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark called me, I think, the summer of 2010, and he said, you're not going to believe this, but Herman Cain's going to run for president, and I'm going to be his chief of staff. And at the time, I thought, well, that's fantastic, because I know Block, and he's aggressive, he's scrappy, and I know Cain. And I just remember thinking to myself, these guys are going to go places. They're going to take the primary by storm. And at the time, I didn't think they'd have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Along the way, Block would call me, who's not, and even Mark would admit he's not a policy guy. He would call me from time to time and say, Cain's talking about repatriated profits, and I don't really even know what they are, but he gets an applause everywhere. What's going on with that? So I was kind of walking through what that issue was and encouraged him to, keep pounding that home. That's a good issue. And a couple of conversations like that led to a phone call saying, hey, do you want to interview for economic advisor? And I flew to Washington to meet with a couple of people, and the next thing I know, I get a call from Cain saying, meet me down in Atlanta and follow me on a campaign trail for a couple of days, and, let's get to know each other. And at the end of the trip, I want you to be my senior economic advisor. And my only two questions for him at the time was, how bold do you want to be? And what do we do if we disagree? And on the first question, you kind of leaned in with that big, you know, bold voice and just said, I want to be bold. And then on the second question, he said, look, lay out the facts, make a case. I'll give you a chance to, you know, state your best case. And then from there, we'll close ranks and, you know, go for it, which is all you can really ask in a case like that.
Right.
So
where do you see your organization in the upcoming, you know, 2016? Where do you fit in? What are you going to be doing?
Well, we're going to focus on this main issue, which is the Fed has caused 40 years of income stagnation for the bottom 90%. If we don't fix that, we're not fixing anything else. So we're going to try to get around to each of the candidates and say, okay, I'm going to give you a magic genie, and you're now the president, and you have three wishes. Economic growth is a game. What do you want? And I would expect to hear something about the tax code, something about Obamacare, something about EPA and the regulations, et cetera. And our response is going to be this. I'll give you all that. I'll wave a magic wand, and you get all of that. Tax code, gone. Obamacare, gone. EPA, I mean, all these things rolled back to 20-year-ago levels. Here's all that's going to happen. We'll get 3 or 4 years of the best growth we've ever seen. And then as soon as the benefits of growth start to reach income of the bottom 90%, and that income rises to a certain level, the Fed will raise rates as many times as it takes to extinguish the wage growth, putting us in the next recession, and allowing the left to perpetuate this false narrative that your right-wing policies don't work.
Right.
It's like we can't keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So we got to put the chain back on the bike first. Then everybody knows what policies cause the pedals to go around. I just want to make sure they all get the chain on the bike first so that when they do pedal, the bike will go somewhere.
Absolutely. Now, where can we go to learn more about you? Do you have a website?
Putgrowthfirst.com.
Okay, great. And is there any way that we can help you in doing what you're doing? Or are you just kind of on your own and you don't need our help?
Oh, no. I mean, there's always you know, more help than you can get. You can go to the website and sign up, which allows us to continue communicating with you.
Perfect.
So as we have updates on what we're doing, as we have, you know, hopefully a task force report that we'll be able to issue at some point, you know, the more people we can get engaged, the better. And in order to kind of stay in the loop, the best thing would be just to sign up at the website. And that will establish a connection.
Perfect. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on with us tonight. You have given us, you know, a lot of valuable information and a lot to think about, more so than I think any of the candidates so far out there and even the people in Congress have given us to think about. And I know our audience really does appreciate that, and I do hope that the audience will go to your website, check it out, sign up, and keep up and keep informed so that they too can spread the word to everyone else about what you're doing and why it's so important and how we can turn things around for our country. So, Rich Lowry, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Susan. It was my pleasure.
Okay, take care.
All right, good night.
Good night. So there you have it. I think we've been given a lot of valuable information that we can use to, you know, help turn this country around. We're always asking, what can we do? How can we make a difference? And I think he's given us a lot to think about. So I would encourage you to go to his website, putgrowthfirst.com, and sign up and continue to learn as much as you possibly can and get the word out there. What he says makes a lot of common sense, and I know that we've, you know, for the most part, we've forgotten a lot of common sense these days under this administration, but we need to get common sense back. We do need to spur on economic growth and get rid of a lot of these federal agencies so that we can get our country back on the right track. So have a great week, and I'll see you again next week. And be well, and God bless you. Take care.